It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're with us here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Coming up on Central Time, snowy owls are popping up all over the state of Wisconsin. We'll talk to an expert from the Department of Natural Resources about why they're here and where we can see them.
First, we've been hearing more news about the shootings yesterday in Paris that killed 12 staff members of a satirical weekly paper. Apart from the tragedy of the attack itself, the concerns about terrorism in the West, there's also been a lot of talk in the last day about the impact of this kind of attack on journalism and free expression.
Here's Secretary of State John Kerry responding yesterday to those attacks.
They may wield weapons, but we in France and in the United States share a commitment to those who wield something that is far more powerful. Not just a pen, but a pen that represents an instrument of freedom, not fear. Free expression and a free press are core values. They are universal values, principles that can be attacked but never eradicated.
Courtney Radge joins us now. She's Advocacy Director of the Committee to Protect Journalists. Courtney, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
So working there on a committee involved in protecting the rights, the freedoms, and the lives of journalists, what went through your mind when you first heard about this attack at the Charlie Hebdo offices yesterday?
It was just so devastating. I actually was living in Paris last year, just a couple blocks down the road, and I just couldn't help thinking what a horrific way to start 2015. You know, last year was one of the most dangerous years on record for journalists, with record numbers killed and imprisoned. The past 3 years have been the deadliest ever since we started keeping records. And I just couldn't believe that in France, which has only had one journalist killed since we started keeping records, there was such a massacre.
And the attack, we don't know all the motives of the attackers, but it's been widely viewed as an attempt to intimidate people, writers, journalists, into avoiding certain kinds of expression. Do you see it that way?
Without a doubt, I think this is a form of intimidation. It's an attempt at intimidation by gunmen trying to make editorial decisions that should obviously be left up to editors and to journalists and not to masked armed gunmen.
And we just heard Secretary of State Kerry say freedom of expression is a universal core value, but how widely is that value really shared in places where journalists have to do their work around the world?
Well, you know, that's a great question. I mean, yes, technically it is a universal Declaration of Human Rights, Article 19, the International Covenant on Civil and Political Rights. But the fact is that it's something that journalists and people around the world are having to fight for every day. We see that, you know, legal structures around the world restrict freedom of expression. The historic levels of imprisoning journalists, there were more than 220 journalists imprisoned last year, which is the second highest year on record. So clearly that's a clampdown on free expression. And I think that in many cases, the idea that expression and press freedom only apply when it's not insulting or when it's not difficult speech is a real misunderstanding of the right. There is actually no right not to be insulted.
Now, you mentioned lots of journalist deaths over 2014 and the years before. As I would understand it, this would often be a journalist who's out in the field doing work. This attack, taking it to an office where the whole staff is that uncommon?
That's a good question. You know, we track pretty specific statistics. I'd have to go through to actually see how many were in the offices. In terms of mass slayings, this is the worst attack on journalists since 2009, when 30 journalists and 2 media workers, along with others, were massacred on their way to during an election coverage event in the Philippines. So, you know, we know that it's usually local journalists who are covering issues of local importance or commenting on issues in their own countries are the ones who are targeted. And in fact, most journalists killed are deliberately targeted with murder in reprisal for what they wrote or what they said. Many journalists, unfortunately, are killed at their offices, as they're leaving or arriving or leaving home to go to their offices. But I don't have specific information about how many are killed in an attack like this. But without doubt, this is a brazen, unusual attack in terms of this nature, although the type of attack in terms of the threat, the fact that these journalists and the media outlet were threatened before they were murdered. We know that the offices were firebombed in 2011, and there have been threats and security as a response to that. In fact, many journalists who are murdered received threats before.
Now, we're paying a lot of attention to this attack in the United States, in part because of the scale, in part because of the freedom of expression issue, in part probably because they were in the capital of a Western nation. Do we pay enough attention to attacks on journalists or the rest of the year and the rest of the world?
Well, we do. You know, the Committee to Protect Journalists actually focuses, I mean, that's why we were founded, and really is to bring awareness to journalists around the world who put their lives on the line. I think there's a natural tendency, you know, globally to focus on those big stories. And, you know, many global media outlets are based in the West, and so they have a natural inclination to cover the stories that are relevant to them. And that's why we see, you know, the brutal murder of, you know, James Foley and Stephen Sotloff, the attention being paid to the Al Jazeera journalists who are in prison in Egypt. And, of course, these barbaric murders getting so much attention. But I think it's important to note that actually the vast majority of journalists who are killed are local journalists. Syria has been the most deadly country on record for the past couple of years, and it was Iraq before that. And, you know, in most cases, they're local journalists who will probably never get coverage in the global media. And that's one thing that we try to do through our daily coverage of attacks on journalists. We have essentially a bio on each journalist who has been killed on our website so that they don't go, you know, killed and they aren't forgotten, so we can remember their names and pictures when possible and the details about who they were and what they sacrificed to bring us the news or comment on public interest affairs.
There's a lot of gloom and doom in journalism on the economic side of things these days, the political harassment you've mentioned, the shootings that you're talking about. Does this discourage, you think, the next generation of would-be journalists? And how do you persuade people that this is a profession worth doing, worth taking these risks?
You know, I think that's a great question. Yes, of course there will be some intimidation and some people will be scared, but what myself personally as a journalist and what I hear from journalists around the world is there are these driven people. There are the people who are running towards wherever the crowd is running against because they want to find out what's happening. So, you know, I don't think that this will deter people. I think it will certainly result in, you know, increased security measures and certainly increased discussions about publishing choices. But I think that people who are driven to journalism want to tell the stories. They want to be on the front lines. They want to be involved in, you know, the issues of our day. And so I don't think that, I hope it won't have a deterring effect on the profession.
As tragic as the shootings are, there's been a worldwide reaction from political leaders, from journalists. There's the Je suis Charlie responses in the online world. Are you encouraged by the show of solidarity for the people who died in these shootings?
I am. I think that it's a global show of solidarity. And, I mean, the cartoons that have come out in support of these, of their dead colleagues, they are just so inspiring, and they capture in so few words and just a few pen strokes such, you know, important ideas. And I think that, you know, from the vigils that we've seen around the world, the vast numbers of people sharing on social media and expressing their support for them is really important, and it's heartfelt. What we need to see is that, that the support translates into actual support on the ground. You know, too many countries around the world have laws in place that make it more dangerous for journalists to work and create an environment that puts journalists at risk. So, you know, if you have blasphemy laws that are punishable by the death penalty or criminal defamation laws that can put journalists in jail for, you know, decades, this creates an environment of fear. And I think another important issue is, you know, around the world, journalists are murdered with impunity. 9 out of 10 killers of journalists are never brought to justice. And so that's another thing I hope that we see this you know, expression of solidarity translate into a real expression of solidarity by tracking down the killers of and murderers of journalists around the world.
Courtney, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thank you so much.
That was Courtney Raj, Advocacy Director for the Committee to Protect Journalists.
For the second year in a row, Wisconsinites are seeing snowy owls here within our borders. Last winter, the number of snowy owls in the Badger State set a record, and experts are expecting this year to be an even better year for bird watchers.
Ryan Brady is with us to talk about why these beautiful creatures have graced us with their presence for a second year in a row. He's a research scientist for the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources and Bird Monitoring Coordinator for the Wisconsin Bird Conservation Initiative. Ryan, thanks for joining us.
Great to be here. Thanks for having me.
Well, why are the snowy owls here in Wisconsin?
Well, it's a little bit mysterious, to be completely honest, but we believe it's mostly food-driven. And when I say that, this is a bird that really focuses on a small rodent that's called a lemming. And this is a rodent that is up in the tundra where this bird spends its summer. And when there's lots of these lemmings, they can raise lots of young owls, and then those young owls disperse south into our area. The alternative possibility, and we don't have a good grip on this, is that those lemming populations crash, and that forces owls to move south in search of food.
Now, for bird watchers, a bunch of snowy owls in Wisconsin is pay dirt. What is it about snowy owls that makes people so excited to see them?
People in general love birds of prey and owls in particular. And then I think the appearance of a snowy owl, its bright white appearance in many cases, its bright yellow eyes are very appealing. They're active during the day, unlike a lot of other owls, so that makes them more visible to a lot of people who don't get to see other types of owls. And I think for some folks, including myself, you know, this is a bird that it's kind of unpredictable, and it's not here all the time, so you tend to not take them for granted. And they have this kind of connection with the Arctic that I may not otherwise have. So in other words, I may never visit the Arctic, but I feel connected to that place by the fact that these snowy owls come down here to Wisconsin.
As you mentioned, they're not always here. They have been the past couple seasons. How unusual is it for them to range here in Wisconsin?
We have snowy owls in the state every year in some numbers. Sometimes it's a very small number, as in handfuls, and in other years it can be dozens. It's fairly unusual to get hundreds of them like we have this year. However, last year was a year where we also had hundreds, and there's been other years in the past where we've had those sorts of numbers. Now we have better communication tools than we've ever had before in terms of getting the word out and kind of tracking sightings by the many bird watchers that we have in the state, things like eBird and Facebook and other types of electronic communication. These are things that really let us kind of get a better grip on those numbers. And that's why, in part, it seems like we have as many as we do.
Now, you said they hang out on the ground, which is unusual. And when I saw one last year, I think it was on the ground, just sitting there for a long time. Is that typically what they do when they head to Wisconsin? They find some area and they just sort of look for whatever they find, mice or whatever, on the ground?
Yeah, so once they find a place they like, they'll kind of stick into that general area, that territory or that home range. And they'll spend a lot of their time just sitting and roosting. And then they spend part of their time hunting. And a lot of time they spend the daytime hours actually just sitting there not doing anything. As a lot of people listening can probably attest to, it can be awfully boring watching a snowy owl sometimes because they just sit there. They really prefer to hunt at dawn and dusk and even into the early nighttime hours. But sometimes you do find them hunting during the day as well.
Now, as I understand it, we are not a lemming-rich environment here in Wisconsin. So what all are they eating while they're down here?
Well, essentially analogous to lemmings, we have plenty of small rodents here. And that's really what the majority of the birds cue in on most, so voles and shrews and mice and so forth. But they do have a wide diet. They'll eat rabbits. They'll eat large birds. Some of them really take to eating ducks and other types of waterfowl. They'll eat weasels. So pretty much anything is fair game when a snowy owl is around.
Now, you said it's kind of a mystery about why they're here. It could be related to a crash in the lemming population. Are scientists trying to get a better handle on where these owls come from and where they go?
Yeah, so there's a project that brewed up last year. It's called Project Snowstorm. And this is a project that is based out of some researchers in the East Coast, but they're doing work throughout the Midwest, including Wisconsin. And they're putting small tracking devices or transmitters onto the a selection of owls, and that can monitor the owl's movements without hindering its movements at a very fine level of precision. And it tracks that data all the way through its entire life cycle, so whether the bird is here or not. Those units operate in a very innovative way. They use cellular technology. So the bird has to be within cell phone range to transmit the data. And so when a bird leaves cell phone range, the transmitter still collects data on that bird, but it's not until it comes back into range that we get all the data out of it. And so four of these owls were tagged last year in Wisconsin, and we tracked them through the winter and learned about how big their territories were and what their temporal patterns were and so forth. And then they moved to the north, and they have not yet come back into cell phone range. That doesn't mean they're not collecting data. It just means we have not had them come back yet. And we're crossing our fingers hoping that that happens, because when it does, we'll get a lot of great data on where that bird spent its past summer.
And in the meantime, are you starting to track a new batch of birds this year?
Yes, the project, like I said, it goes across the eastern U.S. There is a current effort to tag more owls this year, including a couple more here in Wisconsin. That has not yet happened, but it could be any day now.
Now, for people who are listening and they really want to see one of these snowy owls, so far it's 226 or something like that and counting, where can they go to have a good chance?
Well, the birds are being found across the entire state. The one place they like open landscapes, so they don't like heavily wooded areas. So you want to head out into an open habitat that kind of mimics that tundra feel. And once you're in that habitat, just look around on basically any perch. They'll sit on the ground, on posts, on hay bales, on telephone poles, on buildings. They're really well known for kind of sitting anywhere. And take a look, you know, especially on a day that's not too windy, maybe not too cold, and keep an eye out for all those white blobs. And so that's a general approach. A more specific approach is to kind of take a look at ebird.org, and you can find a map of where all the sightings are. And some of the hot spots are the Collins Marsh area from Green Bay down into Appleton, Buena Vista, Horicon Marsh, the Highway 29 corridor between Wausau and Eau Claire, the Superior area, Antigo, as well as a few areas in southern Columbia County near Madison Audubon's Goose Pond Sanctuary.
Somebody in your line of work, have you had a lot of solid sightings yourself?
I have. I've been fortunate over years. I'm based out of Ashland, so I'm way up in the north, and we get snowy owls most years. And so over the years, I've gotten to see hundreds of these things, which is, you know, really fabulous. This year, I'm a little jealous because I've only seen a handful of them, while folks to my south are seeing a lot more.
Uh-huh. Well, my mom is one of these people who's really excited about the snowy owls that are showing up in the state. But she's following these websites, these listservs, and she says they're blowing up. A lot of controversy because people who go to look for these owls sometimes are getting awfully close and they're bugging the other people who think you should keep a bigger distance. What's proper owl watching etiquette?
Yeah, I wish I could give you kind of a magic solution to this, but it is kind of a touchy issue. What we need to do is kind of err on the side of caution and keep the bird's welfare in mind when we go view these things. Snowy owls have never seen people. In some ways, they will not necessarily react to you at relatively close distances. That doesn't mean you should be that close. And so I always kind of keep a mantra of respect the bird, respect private property, and respect each other. And when I say respect each other, I mean don't block the roads if cars are needing to get by standing on the roads. Don't go flush a bird if, you know, a bunch of other people are there trying to watch it. Respect private property. Obviously, we don't want to trespass in viewing these birds. And then most importantly, respect that bird. If you're too close, that bird will be watching you more than it's doing anything else. The bird might flush. Don't go flush it again. If the bird's kind of perched upright, really erect, that means it's probably paying attention to you if it's staring your way. So the last thing I would emphasize in that regard is the cumulative impacts, and that's really important. If any one of us were to do any of those things, it's probably not the end of the world, to be honest. But if the next person who's driving along that road comes along and does the same thing, and then the next person, you see where I'm going. Those are the impacts that really have a negative impact on that bird's survival.
And briefly, the snowy owl's cousins. Are there other owls we have a good shot at seeing this winter? I know they tend to be more active at night.
Yes, some of our resident species, great horned owls, are really ramping up their calling activity now as they begin to court and get ready for the breeding season, believe it or not. So that's a bird a lot of folks might hear. Barred owls are a woodland owl that folks might hear. We do have a northern hawk owl in the state that's being seen near Eau Claire. That's a rare northern owl as well that's made it farther south than usual and is getting a lot of attention. And then short-eared owls are another one you may see when you're looking for snowy owls. They're a small, brown, kind of crow-sized owl that hunts mostly at dawn and dusk in these open grasslands and open wetlands, kind of like the areas the snowies frequent. And you may catch a glimpse of one of those.
Owls are really charismatic. You've obviously seen a lot of them. Do you have a favorite?
Oh, snowy owls are my favorite. Yeah, definitely. I just think they're beautiful. I love the fact that they've come thousands of miles from where they've come from. And you often see them at a time, Wisconsin winter, when there's not a lot of other birds around.
Ryan, thanks a lot for joining us.
Well, thanks for having me.
We've been talking to Ryan Brady, research scientist for the Wisconsin DNR and bird monitoring coordinator for the Wisconsin Bird Conservation Initiative. While the economic recovery has been steadily gaining ground this past year, recent reports show it seems to be bypassing young people.
Even though the economy has been adding around 200,000 jobs per month, wages have been stagnant, and younger workers in particular have seen their incomes grow 60% slower than the national average.
Derek Thompson joins us now. He's a senior editor at The Atlantic, where he writes about economics. Derek, welcome back to Central Time.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
So how much have wages declined for young people between the ages of 25 and 34? One of the groups you look at.
Right. When you look at this group, young people between the age of 25 and 34, which some people consider the sort of employable sector of the millennial generation, you do see that wages have declined in just about every major industry except for healthcare. They've declined tremendously in leisure and hospitality. Typically, this is where you find restaurant jobs or barista jobs. They've declined by 8 to 10% in retail and wholesale. That includes two of the most common jobs in the country, cashiers and retail salespeople. So this is between 2007 and 2013, since the recession began. And you do find that wages adjusted for inflation have fallen just about everywhere.
And what about an even younger group of people, those between 18 and 24?
It's sadly the exact same story. Once you take out the sector of healthcare, where wages have grown for a couple complicated reasons we can talk about later, you still see that for young workers between 18 and 24, so those who have graduated from high school and chosen to go right into the labor force, those choosing to work part-time while going to college, and those who are just a year or two out of their bachelor's of arts or science, whether they're working in retail or leisure and hospitality or in a professional common white-collar job, the studies show that wages adjusted for inflation have fallen across the board. So even if the wages appear to be growing in number year to year, they are falling behind even the slow rate of growth in prices for healthcare, housing, groceries, and clothes.
Okay, so if I'm hearing you right, it's not that the wages themselves are being lowered, it's that they're not keeping up.
Exactly. We're looking at inflation-adjusted wages. That's typically what people look at. It's very, very rare for wages, what economists would call nominal wages, to drop. That is, for somebody to earn $50,000 one year and then be asked to earn $49,000 the next year and $48,000 the year following. There is a theory in economics called the theory of sticky wages, which suggests that because it's such a tremendously it's a tremendous psychological blow to actually have your wages lowered, what you tend to have is wages frozen. So as the price of other goods grows, your wage does not.
So in terms of the why, which is the big question here, what are some of the culprits that you're looking at?
The most important culprit when you're looking at jobs and income earned from those jobs is this familiar Bash Brothers of technology and globalization. And they're a Bash Brother because they work together. Essentially, they conspire in many ways to gut middle-class jobs by either sending work abroad, say sending manufacturing jobs abroad to China or the rest of Asia, or replacing certain routine-heavy jobs with automation, with software. software. There was a really fascinating 2013 study by David Auteur and some other economists that looked at what exactly the effect of globalization technology was, and it said that they have subtly different roles, that computerization technology doesn't reduce employment, but it does reduce the number of decent-paying routine-heavy jobs, and so it sort of guts the middle of our spectrum of jobs. And then globalization has outright taken jobs that used to exist in many cities, particularly in the current Rust Belt, and simply sent them overseas.
And how does this compare to older workers? Are we seeing a symmetry there too?
We are seeing a little bit of asymmetry there. You know, wage growth hasn't been good for any generation, but it's been particularly bad for young people. And, you know, one of the most important reasons for that is that, A, young people, you emerge as part of this enormous cohort of people desperate for jobs. And people in the few areas that were hiring in 2009, 2010 knew that they could pay just about anything to get young people to work for them because jobs were so scarce. And that definitely put downward pressure on wage growth. The other thing is, it is just commonly true that young people tend to be paid a lot less than older people. This is it's a factoid. It's completely self-evident. But as a result, it becomes easier to not pay young people nearly as much money. And so you've seen, I think, entry-level jobs essentially have their wages frozen, particularly in some of these low-skill areas in leisure, in hospitality, in retail, in wholesale. These employers have essentially realized that they don't have to raise their entry-level wages at all for six consecutive years, and they can still get young people applying to these jobs because the market for work is so tight.
Entry-level jobs typically don't pay, you know, what you would earn down the road. Is this to be expected in a certain sense? Is this something that you recover from? You put in your time at a job that pays less, and then you graduate to higher-paying jobs, and then economically you start building wealth.
Absolutely. That is an incredibly familiar story, and it has happened before, and it could happen again. One reason to be optimistic is that the economy, although it's had a bad recovery overall, certainly a slow and plodding recovery, is doing a lot better now. We had fantastic growth in the final quarter of 2014. We have an unemployment rate which is steadily falling. We're creating more than 200,000 jobs a month. So the recovery seems to be on track. At the same time, there is a little bit of evidence that suggests that if you have the misfortune of graduating into a recession, the penalty of graduating into recession stays with you. It's not a cut that heals; it's a scar. When Lisa Kahn, I believe a Yale economist, looked at the effect of graduating into the Reagan recession in the early 1980s, she found that those unlucky graduates saw their wages penalized for decades after the Reagan recession was over. So there's both the optimistic case that we're getting back to normal and the pessimistic case that there are some generations or are some graduate years that are simply more unlucky than others.
All right. And as you said, we're supposedly in a recovery right now, which means the economy is adding jobs. Things seem to be looking up. So does that mean that we're seeing any indication of that same thing happening in wages for young people?
We just haven't seen that much wage growth, honestly. Even as we've added a good number of jobs in the last year in particular, the question used to be, where are the jobs? Now the unemployment rate is falling fairly steadily, and jobs are growing fairly steadily. The new question is, where are the wages? We seem to be creating jobs most effectively and most consistently in those very industries that don't have high wages. And so one way to think about this sort of conceptually, even visually, if I can do that trick on the radio, is to say, imagine that the jobs that exist in the United States exist along a spectrum from low-paying to middle-paying to high-paying, and you can sort of see a nice little stepladder. Well, what's happened because of computerization and software development and globalization is that a lot of those step two jobs, those middle skill, middle class, middle paying jobs, those have declined. And the step one jobs, the low-skill, low-paying jobs, have grown fairly steadily in the recovery. And so what you have is a gutting of the middle, an evaporation of middle class work, which is being made up in the short term in job creation on either end, but as a result means that for lots of people who otherwise would be working in the 1970s in a manufacturing union and earning a decently comfortable salary, a lot of them now are working in retail or restaurant jobs that are not paying similar wages. And so I think that would be the chief concern, is that the composition of jobs has changed and will continue to change in the near future.
Does it also mean it's getting a lot harder to make a jump from a beginning level job to the third tier on the ladder, the one that pays even more after the middle, because you can't really skip a level?
That's a great point. That's a really interesting point. You know, I think that you find that on the one hand, this is the most educated generation in the history of the country. More kids in the millennial generation are graduating from college than any previous generation, and that's a fantastic thing. But at the same time, we have the misfortune of having belonging to the most educated generation in American history that also happened to graduate into a recession. And so an outstanding question for economists and far more importantly for young people is exactly the one that you asked. Which of these two forces is going to win in the long term? Will it be the college degree, which has historically been an extremely dependable ticket to punching your way into the upper middle class? Will the college degree win, or will the recession win? Will the structural changes in the economy can fight back against this incredibly educated generation? And that, unfortunately for our purposes on this show, is a question that I simply cannot answer.
We're talking right now about the shrinking incomes of young workers, and we'd like to hear from you. What does the current job market look like for someone between the ages of 18 and 34? Are you one of these young workers, maybe got out of school during the recession, out of college, and you're finding it difficult to make a jump to a middle-tier job, maybe even to one of these entry-level jobs? And how do you think we need to reverse this trend? What impact is it having on your life? Call us at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can chime in on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking about younger workers dealing with stagnating wages and how it affects their lives and the economy. We want to hear from you. Have you or maybe your kid recently entered the job market for the first time? Do you as a younger worker feel you're being paid a living wage? And given the job prospects out there, does this affect decisions on things like, you know, buying a car, starting a family, buying a house? Call at 800-642-1234, post on the Central Time Facebook page, or tweet us at Central Time WPR.
Derek Thompson stays with us. He's a senior editor at The Atlantic, where he writes about economics, labor markets, and the entertainment business. And we're going to go to the phones right now. We've got David joining us from Prairie du Chien. Hi, David.
Hi, how's it going?
Good, thanks.
With trillion-dollar student loan debt and wages that can't keep up with inflation, how are these workers ever going to pay off their student loans? Won't they be saddled with that for the rest of their lives?
Great. Thanks a lot for that question, David. And you were getting at that a little bit before, Derek, about sometimes this is a hit that stays with you for a long time, longer than you might expect. And is this one of the areas that you might never, you know, be able to catch up on, or at least have a harder time at it?
This is a really important policy question, and I think that the Obama administration is exquisitely sensitive to the fact that one of the side effects of this being the most educated generation in American history is that it is also the most indebted young generation in American history with regard specifically to student debt. And so as a result, one of their policies is to limit student debt payments to 10% of your income by month, so that you are never asked to pay pay too much of your salary, whatever it is. And if you simply keep up with payments, then they'll retire the debt after a certain number of decades. This is one solution to a problem that I think is more broadly intractable, which is that there are a lot of people. It's a cultural problem. It's a broken social contract. It's the idea that you have millions of people who thought that going to school would punch a ticket to the middle and upper middle class and beyond, and in fact graduated into an economy worse than the one that they went to school in. And so people are feeling like this is an unfair bet. And, you know, a policy solution is to say, well, limit the amount of money you have to pay per month. But the larger question, the more important question, is whether those young people are going to be able to earn enough in their 30s and 40s to participate not only in the economy and the consumer economy, but also be able to put together a family, a home, a car, the trappings of the American dream.
Great. Thanks a lot for your thoughts, David. Appreciate that. And we talked about that on the show about a month ago, Derek, about why millennials weren't buying homes. And that seems to be a piece of the puzzle
right
here. As you said, a benchmark of the American dream, sometimes of being adult, getting married, buying a house, or just saving money for something. Is that all going to be affected in this?
This is a huge question. The irony is that past recoveries have been won and lost on the ability of households to buy houses and cars. But this recession was all about debt. It was all about people not buying homes anymore. And so you didn't have one of these engines that typically drives recoveries from the start. That engine was dead. And I think that with regard to this generation specifically, A, they just don't have enough money. The simplest Occam's razor explanation for why you don't see as many car purchases and home purchases among the millennial generation is a simple math problem. There is not enough money in the bank account to buy these bigger ticket items. But separately from the simple math, I do think that there is a larger cultural question of whether things are changing in ways that it becomes possible to live a happy life without a large exurban home and a car. We are seeing more people gravitate to large cities with public transportation. We're seeing the proliferation of mobile technologies allowing people to have driving options like Zipcar and Uber and Lyft, which allow them to have access to wheels without actually owning them. And then with homes, because people are living closer to urban centers, which tend to be dense, you don't have as much house. So even though young people, I think, want to have a place they can call their own, I would not be surprised if those sort of homes look more European, so to speak, a little smaller, a little more densely packed together.
We'll go back to our phone lines now. Erica is joining us next in Madison. Hi, Erica.
Hi.
What do you think?
I think I've actually been in human resources for a number of years now. I graduated from college in 2005. And one of the issues that I see, I guess, I don't know if you want to say with my generation or the generation that we're dealing with sometimes, is their expectations when they come out of school. Sometimes people think just because they have a degree, they should earn $45,000-$50,000 a year. And, you know, with no internships, no work experience, no nothing, and you get people that you're offering them decent entry-level jobs with a salary of, you know, $28,000 to $35,000 a year, and they just think it's beneath them.
Okay, thanks a lot, Erica. And Erica, getting at some intergenerational conflict, we've seen a lot written about millennials. Millennials, I'm sure, contesting some of what's been written about them, some of what Erica is saying there. What do you think about, you know, sort of things like a work ethic?
This is a really interesting question, and I think that she really hit the nail on the head when she talked about expectations. One of the things that I've written about is that I think that there's an enormous expectation gap in the millennial generation, and college plays a huge role in it, and the recession plays a huge role in it. But a part of it, I think, is just cultural, that the culture of college is one of customizability and choice, and you're at the center of this universe of options, and you get to select your major and your dorm and your classes and your thesis and thesis advisor. And then you graduate in the real world, and in the real world, corporations' structure, their organizational structure, doesn't oscillate to improve upon the to basically make 22-year-olds happy. And so I think that you have this expectation gap that exists there, and human resources departments of larger organizations and smaller organizations are going to be exquisitely sensitive to it. The other thing that I think is really important to make clear, possibly at a younger age, even 17, 18, is one thing that's really interesting that Erica said is that internships are an enormous part of the hiring process, that people look for internships to determine what your particular workplace skills are. That is not message that I got when I was 17 or 18. I'm in my late 20s now. So I did not realize the importance of internships until rather late in the game. And high schools and colleges should probably do a much more explicit job of letting upwardly smart young people know that when they turn 21 and 22 and start looking for work, they're going to be judged by their internships and work experiences as much, if not more, than their college, their major, and their grades.
I think we have time for one more quick call. Samantha is next in Sturgeon Bay. Hi, Samantha.
Hi, how are you guys?
Good, thanks.
Good. So, yeah, I'm 24, and I graduated in 2013, and I have a retail job that I've had since I've graduated, and they do pay well. I got a raise. I wasn't paying well at first, but I got a raise. However, they don't offer any benefits, and, you know, I've searched around for other jobs. Most of them are farther away than where I live, and typically they're not in the field that I went to school for. So I think that's another issue we're having in my generation is that...
Okay, I'm going to cut you off there, Samantha, just so we have time for Derek to respond. Derek, just briefly, what would you say to Samantha's concern there about retail jobs?
She mentioned the word compensation. That speaks to a really important point here, which is that healthcare costs have grown tremendously in the last not just few years since Obamacare was passed, but frankly the last decade, the last two decades. And one of the major reasons, and I'll close with this, one of the major reasons why take-home pay has not increased as much is that overall compensation actually is growing, and more of that compensation is going into paying for things like healthcare.
Derek, thanks a lot for joining us today.
My pleasure.
That was Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic, where he writes about economics, labor markets, and the entertainment business.